crew back to safety, and he gives up his goal and begins to get his crew back to safety. What is complicated about this is they have to abandon the ship in the middle of the ice floe. And so they've got to get back from almost Antarctica back to, like, the nearest tip of land without a ship, which is exceptionally complicated. And over the course of the story, you find out that he actually does it. He leads his crew back to safety, and they don't lose a man in the entire story. So he leads, and the whole staff is like, wow, now this is an inspiring leader. Like, this guy's amazing. Like, I am so impressed that he would be able to rally the troops in what seems like a hopeless situation and inspire them to keep going. And they had to do some weird stuff to make it, but they made it. And halfway through the conversation, I realized something. I realized actually several somethings. Number one, people had already been to the South Pole before. And number two, somebody was on the other side of the South Pole ready to do like a food drop for him so that they would have food halfway through the trip, which means, by the way, that on their trip back to civilization, they didn't have enough food. So they had to figure this all out. And I remember saying to the staff, wait a minute, somebody had already gone to the South Pole? So why is he doing this again? And they're like, well, it's the South Pole. It's so amazing. He gives up this vision in order to, like, get his crew back to safety. I'm like, of course he does, because it's his fault they're down there for no reason. This isn't good leadership. This is irresponsible. He's just wasting their lives. Clearly, I had a different vision of this than everybody who's... This book is called Endurance. It's actually a bestseller. Apparently, most people don't think this way, but I don't understand. If this has already been done, what's the point? If you know somebody's, like, just across the continent waiting for you, what's the point? This seems incredibly meaningless to me. And our whole conversation tonight is going to surround this word meaningless. We're going to ask ourselves, what is meaningful and what is meaningless and what makes the difference? That's the entire question or conversation that the book Ecclesiastes wants to have with you. What makes something meaningful? And what makes it meaningless? Because I don't think any of us want to spend our lives and then look back on it and think, man, my life was meaningless. That is not, nobody signs up at the beginning. No 6-year-old, or let's say 8 or 9-year-old, is going to, like, when you draw something about what you want your life to be all about. You know, when you can see, like, the picture of the fireman that one kid draws and the picture of, like, the actor that some kid draws and, you know, whatever pictures it draws. And then, can you imagine if one kid just said, meaningless, on their piece of paper? First of all, we'd be proud of them for being a good speller. But second of all, you'd be like, that is not an okay answer for a 7-year-old. That's a little scary, right? Like, everybody starts their life off wanting to, even if we can't put it into words, we want to have purpose in our lives. And so this book is really all about that. And the thing that I want to suggest that this book... This is a complicated book to read. And it's a complicated book to read for several reasons. First of all, it's a complicated book to read because it is by the wisest man who has ever lived. So when you start reading this book, you have to know you are jumping into a conversation with a man who is kind of out of our league. Just to be honest, like, he is wiser than all of us. And so when I'm around people that are wiser than me, I often have to ask them to repeat themselves. Can you say that again? Can you say that in a different way? No, like another different way? Like a 14th different way would be very helpful to me right now. How about a story? Can you tell? This is always my answer to everything, right? Can you just tell me a story? I'll be okay with that. You know, then maybe it'll be simple enough I can get it. But, you know, when people are wise, we have to go back at what they have to say. And so we shouldn't be surprised when we're in a piece of the Bible that is by the wisest man who has ever lived. We shouldn't be surprised if we have to go back over it a couple of times to really understand what it has to say. The other thing we shouldn't be surprised about, if you were here when we talked about Proverbs last week, I think it was, we took note of a proverb, and I've noted this several times throughout the years. One of the things that the book of Proverbs is really great one-liners from a wise man. And one of the one-liners that it repeats itself throughout the book of Proverbs is that wise people tend to keep their mouths shut, and foolish people tend to keep talking. So here we have a book, or a short book, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, that is by a wise man. And so we should not be surprised if the answers are very brief when he's saying, and he describes the problems in lots of detail. The problems really, he'll say, you know what, this is meaningless and that is meaningless, and we'll go on and we'll look at that. And then the answers are very brief, and you have to really look for them. Because he's really kind of quoting everybody else. This is, you know, all this other stuff that people say all the time. And when he gets to his point, he says it very briefly. Because wise people aren't looking to, like, take hours to say stuff. They're looking to say as little as possible. And so we really have to hunt in the book of Ecclesiastes for the couple of verses that give us keys to how to understand it. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to really look at the two halves of this book. Because the book really is about two things. It really says it's not about what you do, it's why you do it that gives your life meaning. It's not about what you do, but rather it is why you do it that gives your life meaning. I want you to hold on to that. That's our general idea. If I could summarize the book of Ecclesiastes into one sentence, that would be my one sentence. And this, by the way, is a great way to read the Bible. Read a whole book of the Bible and try to capture the meaning of that one book in a sentence. Try to capture the main idea. Almost every book in the Bible has kind of one big idea, one main point. And if you can try to capture that for yourself in a sentence, it will make sure that you remember what the book is all about. So it's a very helpful kind of technique. But so that's my one sentence for Ecclesiastes. It's not about what you do. It's why you do it that gives your life meaning. So let's take the first half of that. It's not what you do. The key word in the book of Ecclesiastes is the word meaningless. The word meaningless. Now, the word meaningless has a lot of different meanings. The original language that this particular book was written in, which was ancient Hebrew, the word meaningless means just a breath. It means just a breath. That's kind of the concrete idea behind the mental picture of the word meaningless. Now, we all know that breathing is significant. Everybody wants to keep doing it all the time. So, breathing is important, but breathing has certain kind of negative meanings to it, doesn't it? A breath. A breath, for example, is very short. It's very transitory. And so, for example, in the book of Psalm 39, it talks about mankind, a person, as a mere breath. Now, what it really means is, in the scope of history, we don't really live very long. In the scope of history, our lives are a mere breath. Now, if you were to read Psalm 39, it would say something like, a mere breath. But it means that same word that in Ecclesiastes means meaningless. So that's the kind of idea that it's just a mere breath. It's very short. It's very transitory. It doesn't last very long. Then it also can mean unfulfilling. So, for example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 1, Ecclesiastes 2, 1, we see this comment. Ecclesiastes 2, 1 says, I said to myself, you know, I tell so many great stories that this is like the punchline. You know, I says to myself, but the wisest man on the earth is talking to himself, which is very encouraging for the rest of us. I said to myself, come on, let's try pleasure. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. Meaningless here means unfulfilling. Unfulfilling. He got all this stuff, and he had all of this pleasure and experience, and it all didn't mean much to him at the end of the day. And then the final thing that this sort of means is the idea of senseless. So in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 10, it says this. It says, I've seen the wicked people buried with honor, yet they were the very ones who frequented the temple and are now praised in the same city where they committed their crimes. This too is meaningless. Meaningless there, of course, means senseless. It means, man, I saw these evil people, and they're honored when they're honored in the very place where they committed crimes. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So this is the kind of idea that we're talking about. We're talking about short, unfulfilling, and senseless. And you know, from a certain point of view, that captures life really well, doesn't it? Sometimes it feels an awful lot like life is short, and life is unfulfilling, and life is senseless. And because of this running, it is this running theme throughout the book of Ecclesiastes that made several people text me this week and say, Pastor Joshua, please tell me this gets better. Because this is a tough read. But you know, the thing I like about the Bible is that the Bible is very raw and real. If life can feel meaningless, senseless, short, and unfulfilling, the Bible is going to be real with us. It's going to give us some ways to understand the world differently. But thank goodness the Bible can be real about that. You know, so often I interact with folks who are dealing with a lot, dealing with losses in their lives or dealing with depression, and they experience the world in a very dark way. So did this guy. And this guy was okay with Jesus. God loved this guy. And so it's okay if sometimes you are looking at the world and it looks pretty dark and it looks pretty dim. You can read this book if only to know that somebody's 100% with you on that. It is sometimes just to know somebody else sees the world the same way you do. And this guy does. And so I want to pause for a minute and just make sure we catch all the different ways that the book of Ecclesiastes tells us that everything is meaningless. So here, we're going to just run through a couple of places in the book. So start in chapter 1. Chapter 1, verses 9 and 10 say this. It says this, history merely repeats itself. It has all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. Sometimes people say, here's something new, but it's actually old. Nothing is ever truly new. We don't remember what has happened in the past, and in the future generations, no one will remember what we're doing now. Not encouraging. But you know, we live in a society that loves novelty. Man, we love something new. Everybody, you know, like, style changes every 3 months, right? Shows have to change. We can't even do a whole season of a show anymore, right? Like, the season of the show has to be cut off in the middle and pushed, and has to put something in the middle, because we can't even watch the same show for 7 months because we get bored, right? Like, we love new stuff. There's a new fact. My kids got fidget spinners. And you're all thinking, that is so dumb. And I thought that was so dumb until somebody reminded me about Pogs. Hey now, right? Because we all love novelty. And whatever age you are, you could think back and tell us the novelty items when you were a kid. And if we were honest, we could tell you each other the novelty things we like right now. We love novelty. And Ecclesiastes is saying, it's not really novel. People had seen spinning things before that. They called them tops. Yeah, it's a very clever idea to make something spin. Great. That's good. You know, like, nothing's really very original. Novelty is just an illusion. And then it goes on to say this in chapter 1, verse 13. I devoted myself to search for understanding and to explore by wisdom everything being done under heaven. This verse has got to end well, right? This just sounds so good. I soon discovered that God has dealt a tragic existence to the human race. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really, it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. It's even saying that knowledge and wisdom can be meaningless. And you know, and some folks think if they read one more book, or let's be honest, some of us think that if we buy one more book, but the better among them think that if they read one more book or watch one more documentary or one more YouTube video or one more whatever, one more article, one more whatever, I will understand the meaning of life and it will all make sense. If I can just get a little more information, it'll all make sense. And we have right here this comment, you know what, knowledge is meaningless. And then he goes on, because we're not depressed enough, to chapter 2, verse 1, which we read already a moment ago, that tells us, well, if knowledge isn't it, and wisdom isn't it, and novelty isn't it, well, maybe, you know what, I should just eat, drink, and be merry, because pleasure's all I can do. And he says, you know, at the end of the day, I was really rich, and I had every opportunity to get every kind of pleasure in the entire world, and it was all meaningless. So that's out too. And then he goes on, and he says that in chapter 2, just a little later, he says that wisdom is meaningless. And then he goes on, I grew up in a family that said that hard work always pays off. If you just work hard, it'll all be okay. My grandparents worked their way through the Depression. My parents worked hard and raised themselves up into the middle class. My whole family story is just work hard, work hard, work hard. And we see just a couple chapters later, I love this. This is painful to me because it hits home. In chapter 2, verse 18, I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, for I must leave to others everything I have earned. I would request that whoever's doing that you would turn it off, just because my distractibility will not be able to handle that. Thank you so much. I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, for I must leave to others everything I have earned. And who can tell whether my successors will be wise or foolish? You know, you work hard, you work hard. My grandfather passed away just probably about 7 years ago now. He had worked very hard, and he took nothing with him. And that is the truth about every person in life. You can work as hard as you want, and you take nothing with you. And so hard work can be just as meaningless as everything else. And then it goes on, 4:13, chapter 4, verse 13, says this. It's better to be a poor but wise youth than an old and foolish king who refuses all advice. Such a youth could rise from poverty and succeed. Yay! He might even become king. Yay! Though he had been in prison. But then everyone rushes to the side of yet another youth who replaces him. Endless crowds stand around him, but then another generation grows up and rejects him too. So it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. Apparently, even ambition is meaningless. Ambition is meaningless. Hard work is meaningless. Pleasure is meaningless. Meaningless. Knowledge is meaningless. Wisdom is meaningless. Novelty is a lie. Where on earth does... No wonder this is a tough book. I was telling Carla earlier, I've never had the courage to teach through the book of Ecclesiastes on a Wednesday. And this is why. Because this book beats a drum hard. And that drum is that it's not what you do. Because whatever you do, it could be meaningless. Whatever you do, it might be a complete and utter waste of your time. Doesn't matter if you're doing good things or bad things, right things or wrong. It actually says that at one point. Like, I mean, this book really goes overboard in saying literally anything you do is meaningless. And then, in just a couple of places throughout the book, hidden are these little gems that give us a hint at how to take a meaningless world and find meaning in it. Because the reality is, it is a meaningless world out there. People are rushing around with their heads cut off, like chickens with their heads. They're not actually running, rushing. Man, like, it would be like zombie apocalypse, like video games happening, right? No. People are rushing around frantic, like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to find meaning. And they try to find it in all those places. They try to find meaning in novelty and knowledge and pleasure and hard work. And they try to find meaning in ambition. And at the end of the day, those are all bankrupt options because they're meaningless. They are short. They are transitory. They are unfulfilling at the end of the day. And they are senseless. But hidden in the book. And this is why, guys, you've got to read the Bible like you're hunting. You got to read the Bible like you're hunting for treasure. You got to get the big picture, but then search. Don't miss a verse. Always read like big chunks of the Bible, because if you skip around, you've got this really good chance of missing the good stuff. The real gems that will give you a shot at living the best possible life you can ever live. And this is one of those books that just has some hidden gems you don't want to miss. And so here we go. We're going to look at three gems, and there's four or five or six throughout the book. We're going to look at three of them. The first one is, and remember, here's the idea. It's not what you do, it's why you do it that gives meaning to life. That's our general theme for tonight. It's not what you do. Anything can be meaningless. Even good stuff can be meaningless if you don't do it for the right reasons. It's why you do it that gives meaning to your life. So, chapter 5, verse 2. Here's our first hidden gem. Don't make rash promises and don't be hasty in bringing matters before God. After all, God is in heaven and you are here on earth, so let your words be few. When you talk to God, it says, much of your time talking to God should be in silence. Much of your way of communicating to God should be about listening. Do you remember this? Did your parents ever say this to you? You have two ears and one mouth. Did anybody ever hear that as a kid? I heard this as a kid. That is just as true when you're in relationship with God as any other adult in your life. You should listen twice as much as you talk. Why? Because, and I hope you already know this, you are never going to tell God something he didn't already know. Never. And so you don't have to get stressed out or worried or frantic about getting God to show up in your life. God already knows what you need. He's already there, and you can trust him. And silence in our relationship with God is a way of showing our humility and our trust. You see, when we enter into a relationship with God, we need to recognize he's here and I'm here. He's up here in heaven. I'm not. He is more important, more powerful, more significant, more good, more holy, more wise, more everything than me. And so I don't need to barge in to God's presence and dictate anything. I don't need to barge into God's presence and think that it's got to be my way or the highway. And I don't need to barge into God's presence and be all frantic. You know, one of the things that the Bible teaches us in this regard is that even asking for miracles can sometimes be a lack of faith. Think for a moment about this story where Jesus is in a boat with his disciples. And Jesus is so unconcerned about life that a storm creeps up, a giant, awful storm, and Jesus falls asleep in the boat. It actually happens. It's in the Gospels. Now, his disciples do something that on the face of it seems really good. They go to Jesus, ask him to take care of them, and have the faith to ask for the miraculous. Jesus, you can calm this storm. Just do it right now. Except that their way of doing it was, Jesus, this storm, and you've got to calm it. And Jesus, we're in so much trouble. No, they're not. There is no trouble here because Jesus is here. There is no problem here because Jesus is here. And so, can you imagine asking Jesus for the miraculous and Jesus' response to you is, wow, you lack faith. Sometimes we think we don't even have enough faith to ask for the miraculous. And Jesus is saying, no, you need more faith than that. You need faith because faith is another word for trust. You got to trust me. And when we walk into Jesus' presence all frantic, all like, oh my goodness, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. I'm all worried about this and I'm freaking out about this. And I will be honest. Like, if I can be really transparent with you, I am an anxious person. You can tell by the way I move that I am an anxious person, right? Like, I got some energy going on. It is very easy for me to, walk into Jesus' presence and be like, Jesus, this needs to happen and this needs to happen and this is going to happen and I got to handle this and this has got to work out and there's this problem over here and this is going to happen in this person's life and this and blah, blah, blah. And like, I can be all frantic, and that's not faith. That's frantic. And we need to just draw a line in the sand and recognize the difference between frantic and faithful. And the verse here tells us you need to have the humility and the trust to walk into Jesus' presence and trust Him, which means be able to just come in silence. Come and be willing to listen to whatever He wants to talk about. Now, this does not mean, please hear me, I'm not saying that if there are things you shouldn't pray about. I am not saying, for example, the disciples should have been talking to Jesus about the potential to capsize the boat. This is a good thing to, when your life is about to capsize, talk to Jesus about it. But take a second and collect yourself and go into His presence and give Him a chance to talk first. Hey, Jesus, seems to me like, can you imagine how much faith it takes to walk in if one of the disciples said, hey, Jesus, how you doing? How's your nap? Anything you want to talk about? Because, hey, I think the boat might capsize if you don't do something, but it's all good. I know you got this one. So what else is going on? That seems silly, but that's a lot more faith, isn't it? Now, that guy needed to ask, hey, please don't capsize the boat. But he just needs to, we don't have to be frantic about it. Jesus has got this. And I'm coming to believe more and more that frantic is the opposite of faithful. And so it's okay. And one of the things we can, Jesus, I am, and I say this all the time, every week I probably say this 50 times, Jesus, I feel frantic right now. And I know I don't have to. So the first thing I need help with is feeling frantic. And then I need you to help me figure out this other stuff. You know, so this is the first key to a meaningful life is humility and trust in Jesus. Humility and trust. Humility and trust will turn actions that seem meaningless or may have been meaningless into something meaningful. Something that seems meaningless into something that's meaningful. Trusting Jesus will do that for you. The second thing is companionship. Chapter 4, verse 9 says this. Two people are better off than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person falls, the other person can reach out and help. But someone who falls alone is in real trouble. That's true. If you fall and there's no one to pull you up, you are in trouble. For a while, I was doing some mountain biking, and I will tell you, as a novice mountain biker, the one thing I would not do was go mountain biking by myself. Because I fell a lot. And sometimes it hurt. I almost said hurted. Sometimes it hurt. And sometimes I fell on rocks. And I got to tell you, I wanted somebody there in case I broke my leg. It's important to have. In the spiritual journey, we desperately need people around us who are going to carry us along. People who are going to notice when we've fallen, when we're not there. You know, when everybody's moving forward and somebody's not there anymore. As a matter of fact, we're going to practice this tonight. I want everybody to pull out your phones. Every single person, I want you to pull out your phone right now. Every person, turn your phone on. Get your phone ready to go. I want your phone out. I want you to be able to text. My small group knows this drill because we do this all the time. But we're going to text. I want you to think about, for those of you who are regular attenders here at East Coast International Church, I want you to think about the last four Sundays. The last four Sundays. I want you to think about every person you can think of you normally see at church who has not been there lately. Or at least you haven't seen lately. Every person you can think of. And I want you to start texting anybody you can think of that you haven't seen at church lately. Anybody. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you saw them one time. It doesn't matter if it's somebody you saw from, you know, from a meeting, but you know been to church a bunch. It doesn't matter if it's somebody from your apartment building or your street or your block or whatever. It doesn't matter if it's somebody that you saw 5 years ago. Because here's the thing. We make all sorts of excuses about why we should not reach out to people we haven't seen in a while. You know what? Maybe they were here in another service, and so they were here, and I don't want to offend them because you're not going to offend somebody if you say, hey, I haven't seen you in a while, and I miss you. This does not, if that offends them, that's on them. Or we'll make these excuses, well, you know, maybe they were there and I just didn't see them, or you know what, maybe they're going to some other church, or maybe they moved and I'm supposed to know that, and so like, I'm going to look so dumb if I ask them where they were. Doesn't matter if you look dumb. That's not what this is about. This is about thinking of every single person, because we want to be the kind of church that is about companionship in the journey. We want to have a net that captures every person that ever stops showing up. We just want to catch them. And we're not perfect at this, but if we all do this, and I want you to do this. This is, you're practicing now because I want this to be a life habit for you. Every Sunday, when you don't see somebody at church, I want you to text them. You are allowed to text in the middle of worship or in the middle of the sermon if you are texting somebody who's not in church that day. You are allowed to text somebody in the middle of anything if it's somebody who is not at church that day. Because we want to be people who notice who's missing and say, hey, we miss you and we love you. That's really important because the vast majority of the time, people stop showing up just because they got out of the habit. They were sick one week, and then their car broke down the next week, and then they were tired the next week, and then they feel like, oh man, I haven't been to church in like a month. And I will tell you what a lot of those folks are thinking. They are thinking, and no one even noticed. That's what they're thinking. Why should I go? No one even notices when I'm not there. So keep texting. Keep texting. I don't care if you think of 50 people. Text them all right now. Every single one. You can ignore the rest of what I say. I don't mind. It is not as important as what you're doing if you are texting people who have not been to church. Most important thing you could be doing. So, and then I'm curious how many texts we as a community can send to people who have been missing. How many people can we reach out to? I don't know. There's like 50-ish people here tonight. I don't know. I would like to know how many, like this is an experiment we're going to do. How wide of a net can we throw to people we haven't seen in a while? Because it's really important that we get good at this. So what I want you to do, if you wouldn't mind, once you have finished texting people, could be one person, it could be two people, it could be 10 people, it could be 20 people, however many people it is, I want you to text me the number of people you texted. Just the number, that's all. You don't, like, I'm going to turn my phone off right now because my phone is going to explode, and that's exactly, I don't know where my phone is. Somebody stole my phone. I'm going to turn my phone off right now so that you can all send me texts of whose, there we go. My phone is off. Send me a number of how many people, it's 5, 3, 2, 8, 1, 20, 500, I don't care. And by the way, for those of you who prefer Facebook or whatever, that's fine. I'm not telling you to. Hopefully you understand that Facebook is great. That's wonderful. So message people, whatever it is you're doing, but as long as it's direct communication between you and a person you haven't seen. And then when you're done, text me the number. And I am going to add them all up either right at the end of the service if I get time or at the beginning of next Wednesday. I'm going to tell you how many people you reached out to in 5 minutes, because it's going to take us like 5 to 10 minutes to do this, right? In 5 to 10 minutes, there might be hundreds of people. There might be 60 people. There might be, I don't know. It depends on how hard everybody works. So I want you to try to hit as many people as you can right now. So that's what you're doing, because companionship can take meaninglessness and turn it into something that is meaningful. Companionship can turn something that is meaningless into something that is meaningful, and that is the second key that we're given here. The final one here is almost the last verse in the book. Chapter 12, verse 13, which says this. It says, that's the whole story. Here now is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey His commands, for this is everyone's duty. That's it. The end of the day, this word, duty, is incredibly important. See, we are in a culture that tries to convince you even to do the right thing because it's what's best for you, because it will have benefits for you long term, because it will make your life better. Even our character is built on complete and utter selfishness. Even the good parts of our character. Why am I doing this? Because it's best for me. Why am I doing this? Because it's a good thing for me to be doing. Because it's going to make me, I feel better when I am kind to people. I do better, like, do you see what I'm saying? Like, we have a very self-centered definition of character. We do good things for selfish reasons. And the final answer that he gives us as a clue to how to find a meaningful life is to give up on selfishness. to give up on self-centeredness. Why am I doing this? Because it's the right thing to do, period. Why am I doing this? Because God said to, period. There is no promise that it will benefit you. There is no promise that it will make your life better. There is no promise that somehow you will get points for this. No promise at all. The question that is asked is, will you, when it is hard, when you don't agree, when it is complicated, when you're not sure how it's going to turn out, what about then? That's when real character kicks in. And his suggestion is that when you cultivate that kind of character, this is the kind of character, by the way, we've told this story before, but in the book of Daniel in the Bible, Daniel is a statesman, and he has three friends who are statesmen, and their names, inconveniently for every teacher since the time, are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three guys are in a heathen country, and the king decides he's going to have everybody bow to this statue. And these three guys love God and say, no, we're not going to do it. So you got to picture thousands of men standing there getting ready to bow. And of the thousands of them, everybody bows down except for three guys who are just standing there in the middle of the crowd. Very obvious. Yes, you are still texting. That's exactly what I want you to do. Don't give up until you can't think of a single person. Keep it up. All right. But these three guys, they're standing there. And as they stand there, eventually the king calls them out and says, you are either going to bow down or I'm going to kill you. And you know what they don't say? They don't say, you know what? God would never let you kill us. They say, God is God whether he lets you kill us or not. They do not have any assumptions about whether or not doing the right thing is going to benefit them. As it happens, it does. But there have been thousands of martyrs before that time and since who have died because they were willing to do the right thing no matter what the cost. And sometimes God has done the miraculous and rescued people from martyrdom, and sometimes he has not. Either way, the choice that someone going into those situations makes is, I'm going to do the right thing no matter what it costs me. And our teacher here tonight, Solomon, the man who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, says, when you cultivate that kind of character, your life will have meaning. It will turn everything in your life into something meaningful. Because if you are doing it out of obedience to God, you will be able to trust that it has meaning because God told you to do it. And that automatically gives it meaning. Incredibly profound, incredibly challenging, incredibly difficult, but that is what this book tells us. And all of a sudden, life has meaning there, and I love that. This book that is full of really down thoughts. Man, pleasure can be meaningless, and yeah, like hard work is meaningless. And you know what? All those things are meaningless unless you're doing them out of obedience to Jesus. They are, 100%, all meaningless. You can work as hard as you want, it's meaningless, unless it's part of God's plan. You can get as much pleasure as you want, it's all meaningless, unless you're doing what God wants you to do. You can get all the knowledge and all the wisdom in all the world, it is all meaningless, unless you are following God's plan for your life, unless you are participating in God's plan for the world. That is the thing that gives meaning. And so we have to constantly be pursuing that in our lives. That is, I think, the heart and soul of the book of Ecclesiastes. That is the last nugget of wisdom we're going to get from the wisest man on earth that has ever lived. So I think we should probably take it pretty seriously.